Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, September the 7th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jerry Pedersen. His subject, The Way of Jesus, The Way of Nonviolence, Resisting Evil in a Positive, Active Way. Let's listen in to this session already in progress.
So they were out militarily to overcome, destroy, to drive out the Romans, set up a faithful Jewish community, nation, as they understood it, in some degree. Let me ask you a question. Which of these do you think Jesus least identified with? The one that he would not have wanted to be part of, no matter what?
Probably the top one.
The Pharisees?
Is that what's on top? I can't read the
yeah.
top thing. So.
That Pharisee's on top. Okay.
I'm not sure about it.
Anybody else like to challenge that or take another?
I can't see him identifying with the Sadducees either.
Yeah, the Sadducees.
Tops, Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, Zealots.
Essenes.
What?
Essenes.
Essenes. That was the one he would least identify with, you think. Okay. Why do you think that?
Not taking an active role.
Just total withdrawal is not... Jesus is more active than that, you say.
I'm guessing.
Okay.
Hey.
And well, why did you...
The Zealots.
You think the Zealots?
Covers up for them.
Great. Yeah, because he wasn't about to overthrow the Roman.
Okay, yep. So... militancy in terms of violence is not his way of saying it. Okay? Well, I'm sure any group you'd ask, and, you know, theologians or scholars, you'd have all kinds of different answers. But at least some people believe, and especially people that are involved in the nonviolent movement, that the least one he would want to identify was the Sadducees. The Sadducees are, when you come right down to it, they're so compromising with the world that's around them and the ways of the world, and they want power, they want wealth, they want prestige, they want status so much that that takes precedence over any faithfulness to Yahweh. That's debatable. Which one do you think Jesus would most identify with? I mean, if he was tempted to be something, because I believe Jesus is saying none of these are what he was proposing. He was talking about an alternative way to all of these, a different way. But he was tempted, maybe, to one of these... closely. Which one do you think it might be? I'm not going to put you on the spot. And here you'll get an argument too. But you don't think any of them. It's thought by many that maybe the Zealots were ones that he was most closely identified with. If he was tempted to be identified with something, at least one of his disciples was a Zealot. Perhaps as many as half of them were Zealots. They took very seriously that we cannot live compromisingly with this system, you know, the Roman way. And they were not going along with the compromisers, the Sadducees, And if you look, if you read the Gospels in terms of how Jesus is struggling, there's some thought that even though he has very definite ideas that's contrary to that, and I believe he finally totally rejects it, I think it's a temptation. And maybe I'm just projecting my own thoughts, because, I said in the first session, and I traced my own history which I was in the Marine Corps, and I was in the Second World War. And I was over on the USS Missouri, the battleship, when the atomic bomb was dropped, and my disappointment at that act. And I was there the day they signed the surrender ceremonies 50 years ago, last Saturday, was it? September 2nd. And part of my determination then to be a peace activist and began thinking about being a pastor and so on. In spite of my commitment, out of all my experiences, my studies to nonviolence, if I lived in the third world, the victims of, I believe, the oppression from first worlds, I'm not sure that I wouldn't be an advocate of, as long as they've got all the power, if they've got all the control, maybe we have to take up arms ourselves, because that's the only thing that'll work. And if I were a black person in the United States, in Los Angeles, in the ghetto, or New York, or Chicago, or maybe other places, and I saw the racist structures of American life that almost guaranteed that if I were a black boy, I'm probably going to end up in jail before I'm through with this system. Now, I reject that. I don't believe that, but I believe that it's among those that are the blessed ones. And boy, the white, Western, American, European, now Japanese as well, those who are at the top of the heap, we're the ones that have to hear the call to nonviolence and start practicing it and put it into reality, or else we're almost guaranteeing that those who are the outsiders and the oppressed are going to say, hey, if you don't practice it, don't expect us to practice it. And I think that would be disaster for everyone. But, yeah, well, Jesus lived among the Pharisees more than any, probably, because that was the dominant religious practice of, and in many ways, he was somewhat close to them in a way, because they did take following the law very seriously. But he also, in the scriptures, all we find him, his defining his position over against the Pharisees, because they were the dominant group in the scribes, the Pharisees, and practice of the people. Although the truth is, he probably was a peasant. As long as he lived in Nazareth, he probably kind of was outside all the major influences, because these parties didn't get down into the peasant life that much. Okay, we're going to look a little bit at why do pacifists or people committed to nonviolence, why do they say this is the way of Jesus? And we've talked about a number of things up to today. Let's look at one specific answer that seems to be a key one in understanding the nonviolent position. You could take a lot of others. You know, love your enemies. I don't think, and that's, when you talk about love, that's the basic definition of love. And everybody I've served, I don't think I've found anybody that disagrees that love isn't the great thing. You know, that's the thing that we all ought to be committed to. Surely as Christians, we're committed to love. We ought to love others. We ought to love our neighbors. But the moment you say start loving your enemies, wait a minute now. That's something else. And I think that is Jesus, in a sense, full definition of what it means, commitment to love. Or we could look at other passages. But let's look at Matthew 5:38. This is in the Sermon on the Mount, of course. And one of the most difficult sayings, and one that's probably been debated very, very often. Matthew 5:38-42. Would somebody read that?
You've heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that you resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. I haven't read this version for so long. Okay.
That's which version?
Well, it sounds pretty King James-y to me, replaced by the Gideon with the reason that...
What was it?
It's got to be King James. Isn't it?
It sounds like it.
I'm reading from the Revised Standard.
I know I'm not reading from that.
Okay.
It sounds King James.
It is what?
King James.
It is King James. Okay. So what was the line 39? But I say
unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn
okay.
to the other.
Okay. The key word where it, you resist not evil. That's the King James Version. Okay. Mm-hmm. And who has a Revised Standard? And what does that say?
But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil.
Do not resist
one who is evil.
One who is evil. Is that the Revised Standard?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Who has a different translation? What do you have? Good News?
Good News. Mm-hmm. I'll read it.
Yes.
You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But now I tell you, do not take revenge on someone who wrongs you. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, let him slap your left cheek off too.
Okay. Okay, Revised says, do not resist one who is evil. That said, do not
take revenge on someone who wrongs you.
Wrongs you. Okay. Any other translation? Okay. Do not take revenge on. So there's some debate as to how this word is to be translated. Do not resist evil, and truthfully, it's very difficult to get the meaning or the sense of what Jesus is talking about from really. These translations, do not resist evil, do not resist the evil one, do not resist the person who has wronged you, or do not take revenge. Is that what that gets closer to the full intent of it? But what when Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, he's referring to the Old Testament law as to how they dealt with evil. And the best place to find a summation of that is is in Deuteronomy 19:16-21. Deuteronomy. And would you let's look that up and read it. Fifth book in the New Testament. I mean the Old Testament.
What was the 16?
19, verse 16 to 21. This is often called the law of retaliation. How do you deal with evil? How do you purge evil from the midst of your life? Somebody want to read it? This is from the Good News Bible.
Yeah. 21?
Yes, go ahead.
If one man tries to harm another by falsely accusing him of a crime, both are to go to the one place of worship and be judged by the priests and the judges who are then in office. The judges will investigate the case thoroughly, and if the man has made a false accusation against his fellow Israelite, he is to receive the punishment the accused man would have received. In this way, you will get rid of this evil. Then everyone else will hear what happened. They will be afraid, and no one will ever again do such an evil thing.
Go ahead.
In such cases, show no mercy. The punishment is to be a life for a life, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, and a foot for a foot.
Okay. Now, this is almost directly, you know, quoting the words that Jesus said, you have heard. That it's a tooth for tooth, eye for eye, hand for hand. It's life for life. This is how you're going to deal with evil. This is how you purge evil out of your midst. Any other method, you're compromising and you're going to have to live with it. You're going to be overcome by it. This is the way to deal with evil. And Jesus says, but I say to you, and he says something other. Beginning this is 16. In verse 19, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to you, or to his brother, so you'll purge the evil from the midst of you. And the rest shall hear and fear and shall never again commit any such evil among you. Your eye shall have no pity. There's no mercy to be shown. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. By the way, I always heard that was the way of the Islam people. And they say it's pretty effective. I would guess it might be. I don't know. What are some characteristics of this law of retaliation?
I read an article about, I think, Singapore. And it has a lot of, when tourists come to visit it, it has, I think everyone, they had a big program to give everyone a house. You walk down the streets, there's no crime whatsoever. And it's because of extreme punishment, where the caning took place. Death penalty for, I think, less than murder. But it's deceptive. People don't necessarily live in happiness. They live in fear of the government. Government's more likely to do things maybe beyond this because their philosophy is do whatever it takes to make the people fear you. I guess that's what comes to mind for me.
Yeah. Well, where you have a very authoritarian, you have a rigid control, where you can enforce it, apparently it gets a lot of results.
I think there's always retaliation, though.
Yeah. And by the way, I've just purchased the book that I hope they got in the library, and they only had two copies. I got one of them. But it's Unveiling Violence, a new book out by Bailey. And I'm going to be talking about that Saturday. It's fantastic. But, I'm not going to get into it now. But, this law is totally reactive, isn't it? Hey, whatever they do, you do it. It's very clear. There's no question about it. It's reactive. You don't have to use much thinking. You don't have to have a lot of wisdom. You don't have to, have a lot of discussion. What do we do? This person did something? What do? You know exactly what you do. And it's also death. The sentence is the penalty of death. The punishment is death. This is all, or at least this always, This always deals with capital crimes, any capital crime, other places that this law is referred to. It calls for death. There's no question about that. It's not, it's, and this hand for a hand kind of thing apparently was exactly carried out. Now, it's against this backdrop that Jesus answers. He says, now you've heard this, and this is the law. This is, if you ask the Pharisees who already committed the law, what are you to do? This is it. If a woman is caught in adultery, what do you do? You stone her, don't you? Isn't that what Stephen did later on? You know, he was there. Not, was it Stephen? That in the book of Acts? Yeah, that was Stephen. He witnessed this stoning. This is the course on nonviolence.
Right.
And you're welcome. Why don't you come up a little closer so you feel like a participant?
Well, we have a reading today, so that's why we're kind
of... Oh, yeah, I see. Okay. Well, where was I?
Sorry. Stoning Stephen.
Oh, yeah. This woman was caught in adultery. Hey, they were out there stoning him. And No.
Stephen was stoned.
Stephen was stoned to death, and it was Paul that was there doing it. That's right. That was a different situation. But it was legitimate to stone him to death. The woman that was taken adultery, that was being stoned to death, Jesus, what was his response to that? Well,
go and sin no more.
Yeah. Well, or earlier he said, hey, anybody hear this without sin, go right ahead, but maybe there might be a lot of other people in the hopper if we're going to follow the law of retaliation. Then he says to the woman, hey, come here, go out. But Jesus says, you've heard it said. And then, as we read in Matthew 5:38, he comes up with his answers. His answer turns the law of retaliation totally on its head, just reverses it upside down. If they once you slap you on the cheek, hey, give them the other cheek. If they want a cloak, give them a second one. Give them your coat. They ask you to go a mile, go on, go a second mile, and so on. So that isn't a natural response. In fact, it's against all instincts that we have. When somebody slaps me, without thinking, and I'm ready to go. And so it's a deliberate. It's something that requires control and discipline in your response. But a couple of things.
Why would you turn the other cheek? I wouldn't turn the other cheek. I'd try and talk to the person or something. I mean, it's not just one alternative or the other.
Let's look at that just a little more carefully in just a minute, okay? I'm not sure that, you know, but we don't really expect precise answers from Jesus as to how you handle the situation either. He's rather giving us a general way that we react to something, not precise, prescribed, to give you new laws in place of the old laws of the Pharisees. He's giving us a whole new response. What are some of the characteristics that Jesus gives us? Well, first of all, it's not a call to react. If somebody slaps you in the cheek, you slap them back. That's reaction. And what Jesus' answer says, wait a minute, don't let yourself get put into a reactive position. Rather, it's important to be able to take the initiative in the relationship. if all we as a follower of Jesus can do is to wait around until somebody does evil to us and then we react to it, if that's the only way you can handle something, you're not being very creative. And you're surely not acting inconsistent with the new way of living that I'm talking about in the kingdom of God, or the realm of God, or the imperial reign, as I've now learned to call it. It gives the power of initiative to the person that encounters an evil one. Beyond that, it's a word of empowerment. No longer just a subject to being reactive. You're enabled to come up with your own response to the evil situation or to the evil person. And not only that, it's not death for death, life for life. It's life affirming. It's seeking a way other than death. What he's getting at in here is to somehow stop the cycle, the vicious cycle of evil begetting evil, violence begetting violence. It's just a vicious circle. By the way, next week I'm doing a thing on forgiveness. And one of the interesting things about people who feel hurt or sinned against is that the two people, if it's two people, they never evaluate the hurt to the same degree. The person that is hurt or sinned against always feels that it was a much more terrible thing than the other person intended. He said, well, I really didn't mean to that much by what I did to you. And the other person says, oh, wait a minute, it was terrible. And then if they react to it, the other person says, all I did was, I just scowled at the person. And he came back and he just said all kinds of mean things about me. You know, the cycle of vicious cycle of revenge and hatred starts escalating. And one person scowled at another to begin with. And after several reactions, somebody's ready to shoot somebody because the two parties never evaluate the harm done or the evil done or the evil intended to the same way, in the same degree. Is that true? Have you had that experience?
I think it's also true as far as turning the other cheek, that without a reaction, it's really hard for someone to slap a second time if the person refuses to slap back. Martin Luther King used that, Gandhi used that. It requires sometimes feeling a lot of pain, but sooner or later, people are basically good, and it's easy to justify being in a fight, but it's a lot harder to justify yourself just beating on someone who refuses to fight back for no reason at all.
Okay, that's inherent in all this. It's stopping a cycle of hatred or of violence and coming up with a new kind of response and a life-affirming response, an empowering response that gives the person who otherwise would have been a victim to try to put them into the position of having dignity and prestige, the prestige of responding, not reacting to what they said, but out of their own deepest convictions and beliefs, value system. The difficulty with the verse, don't resist evil, don't resist the evil person, that's in Matthew 5:39. It seems to suggest that there's only two ways of dealing with evil when you're confronted with it. One is passivity, or violent reaction to try to overcome it. And Jesus is talking about a third way, a different way than either of these two. The difficulty with the usual translation is that it sounds as if there's only two possible reactions to the evil person: submission or violent reaction. And one of the reasons I just don't like the word pacifism is because it seems to suggest this submissiveness, this passive nature. And Jesus isn't talking about being passive in the presence of violence. No, he's talking about a different kind of response that is very active, but it's not violent. He says the choices are not passivity or violence, but it's an active response, but which is either violent or nonviolent. And he's trying to, so that the Good News translation is a good one, which was, don't act in revenge to the evil person. Is that about what it said?
Don't take revenge.
Yeah.
It's the Walter Wink suggests that the real intention, surely not submission, the real intention is do not resist an evil by letting the evil itself dictate the terms of your response. I mean, then you're a victim. If all you can do is what the law of retaliation of the Old Testament says, is, hey, it's an eye for an eye, then you truly are a victim, because all you can do is react. But Jesus is talking about a whole new way, a way in which, because you are a child of God, you're blessed, you're who you are, you have the power to act with your own values, your own initiative, totally free from what you're being forced to by the other person. He surely isn't saying you don't counter evil, but he's saying you don't counter it with violence. His third option, one that would recover the human dignity of the oppressed, the eye for an eye, that doesn't treat the other person with any real understanding or dignity. You try to recover the human dignity of the other and of yourself. You're not a victim. You seize the initiative from the evil person or the oppressor. You overcome fear and you reclaim the power of choice, all the while maintaining the humanity of the other person. This is the key, not to get hooked into the kind of relationships that dehumanizes the other person. Hey, we got a farmer from Iowa who respects me, who has no knowledge of farms, but I have a little knowledge of raising cattle now. You want to shoot a picture? You can shoot it if you want.
How was that?
Do you want to shoot a picture?
No.
Oh, okay.
I can though.
Oh, no, he took one the other day. I thought you wanted to take another one. Okay. Excuse me.
Hey.
Great. Resist not, must not be heard as submission, but as refusing to let the enemy dictate the terms of opposition. It's not lashing back in kind. It's refusal to react reflectively. Knee-jerk action kind of thing. This refusal of reactive opposition is one of the most profound, difficult truths in Scripture. Carl Jung, psychologist, says inevitably you become what you hate. Think that's true? In social relationships, it's very true. How about the arms race? We supposedly have ended that now. I haven't seen really much evidence that we are acting as though it's ended. But after the Second World War, one of our allies became the great enemy, right? Russia, who was an ally, helped us win the war, lost some 25 or 30 million people in the process. And by the way, they were our other ally, because on September 2nd, when I was aboard that battleship, USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay, as part of the honor guard, and 25 feet from the table where they're signing it, here were the French over here with their cameras and their newsreel men, and here were the British over here and the Americans over here. Right behind us were the Russians, and they kept trying to get a little closer up there in a better position, and we had to keep saying, hey, get back, because they were our allies. They were sharing in this whole thing. But after the Second World War, within 2 months, our ship came back to New York. And the papers were talking about the threat of the communists. And within a couple months later, Churchill talked about the Iron Curtain and how, now we had this great, colossal evil that we had to fight against. This is very significant for me because I get caught up in this, letting other people determine who my enemies are. Just kind of react to that. But what about the arms race? Did we become what we hated in the arms race? For 40 years, I don't know how many trillions of dollars we spent building up an arsenal. And no matter how big you build it, you always want to build a little more. And of course, why did we do it? Well, the Russians had all that stuff. Man, they were building armies. And I remember the speech of John Kennedy in 1960. He listed all the airplanes and they had started to develop, they had shot Sputnik up into the sky and a few things. And therefore, we have to build more. We have to develop more. And then, Johnson followed him, and every president got into the arms race question. You become what you hate, what you oppose. It dictates your actions. It's almost like an eye for an eye kind of thing. Carl Jung, you always become the thing you fight the most. How about the alcoholic? Yes?
I'm just trying to think of, the three, maybe I can mention later, the three reactions. The reaction of an eye for an eye, and then what he's saying, the other one would be pacifist, which would just be, you wouldn't do anything. You just let him beat you up, is that what you're saying?
Well,
and then the other one, the third one would be to give him your other coat also.
Well, it's Jesus' way.
So those three would be the three you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, it's the reactive one of violence for violence.
Right. And then the
other is submission. Not the pacifist does not advocate submission. The pacifist, they are committed to nonviolent action, direct action, nonviolence, and so on.
But
the word pacifism suggests that submission, suggests that passivity.
Okay,
and that's why I prefer.
The third one you're saying is the action that Jesus would have us act, and that is to turn the other.
To find a new way. He talked about it as turn the other cheek and so on.
So in this arms race, what would have been the third way?
Ah, good, good. Well, it's much more complicated than, you know, striking on your cheek.
Right.
But
I was sitting here trying to think, and it would have been to bed their people or done something like that to Russia.
Good question. But when I scowl at you, you not only want to scowl back, but, you know, what? And next thing I say, well, why are you scowling at me? And next thing we're fighting.
Right.
And what we're saying in the arms race, there was this, you know, you build more, so we're going to build more. And, no, there has to be a third way. And what are those ways? Well, student exchanges, travel exchanges, trying to create what we share in common, not to demonize the other person, the other party. We, you know, as soon as we decided we had to attack Iraq, what did we do? We demonized their leader, Saddam Hussein. People who had never heard of this guy within a matter of a few weeks began thinking of him as an evil, satanic person. And that's, if you want to create an enemy and you want to get everybody riled up, you demonize it. We demonize the Russians. And you can believe they did it right back to us. And so it's not an eye for an eye. It's not getting into that reactive pattern, but it's a third way. Tomorrow I'm going to talk more specifically what nonviolent direct action. But it's searching for all kinds of alternatives.
Israelis and Palestinians right now, it just seems like one does something more than the other. You
know, absolutely. Some of you that are old enough remember when Carter brought the leader of Israel and the leader of Egypt and got him in Camp David, and they were there for 5 or 6 days, and you know, they hated each other's guts. It was against all odds, but by just talking, by searching for common ground and all, it was a heroic decision that, you know, it didn't solve all the problems, and they're still trying, but it stopped this vicious reactive pattern by a third way. Get to know your enemy and find out maybe they're not the enemy you thought. Maybe they're a human being after all. Maybe they've got some goals inside that are worthy goals. But if all you do is stand apart and treat the other as such an enemy, as an evil person, pretty soon you don't even know the other. You don't respect with any kind of dignity the other person. And so the third way is to try to reverse all that. But you become what you hate. Alcoholics, I'm told that as long as they are going, you know, almost all the alcoholics I've dealt with, they know alcoholism is killing them. They know it's destructive in their lives. They hate it. But I've had guys tell me that. And then they say, excuse me, I gotta go. And they go out, and I follow the guy out to his car, and he reaches and gets his bottle and drinks it. After having an hour's conversation with him, he hates the stuff. Somehow, they have to let go of this. And AAA is, you've got to let go, you got to release. And a whole new process is set up because you become whatever you hate. It's... I believe in the Second World War, which, if there was ever a justifiable war that the United States got into, maybe that was it. Because Hitler was surely demonic, wasn't he? But you know, we fought that war It's interesting, when we were all through, we said, now we got a demonic communism that immediately is an outgrowth of that thing. Or we fought the war. It's interesting. Pearl Harbor was a terrible thing when they unannounced everything, drop bomb, but it was a military objective. Within this retaliation kind of thing, the English, bombs were dropped on London and killed many civilians. What was the response of the English to that? In 1940, before we even got in the war, their response was to start bombing German cities. And within a couple of years, the 43 major German cities were targeted by us and the Allies to try to, you know, just as saturate them, destroy them as much as possible. You become what you hate.
Do you know how many German civilians were killed?
I don't know. I am told that in Dresden, was it over 100,000 in that one night of bombing? But
because I wonder how it compares to the number of Jews that were killed.
Good question.
You know, did we kill just as many innocent civilians in the process?
I don't know. I do know that then in the Japanese war, prior to the A-bomb, we had incendiary bombing of Tokyo. And I have heard the figure of 1 million civilian casualties in Japan. I won't guarantee that. But incendiary bombing is a massive type of thing that you're attacking civilian population, thinking that it's going to do something to their war capability. And then we dropped the atomic bomb. That was 100,000 right there. And then Nagasaki, I guess it was 60 or 80 or something. It probably comes close to it. This law of retaliation tends to create you becoming what it is that you're fighting. You become the evil that you dislike. Evil begets evil. How about our policy for many, many years, up until the so-called close of the Cold War, about nuclear weaponry? We developed our nuclear capacity to make sure it was as much or more than the enemy had. And we made it very clear that we were ready to use it if necessary to oppose any action. By the way, that can be that's a whole study in itself. But really, the potential of a nuclear war that could probably eliminate the human species as well as almost everything else, other living species. We didn't have to do it, fortunately. But you become what it is you hate. That's almost a guaranteed thing. We named Hitler the Beast. We became bestial in the process. Well, specifically, what I wanted to do here, we were talking about the spectrums of violence. Personal overt physical assault is if somebody, well, it's raping another person, it's murder, so on. Institutional overt physical assault is war. It's acting as a state or as a society It's capital punishment. But then we get into covert violence, where personal covert violence is where I treat a child, for instance, in a dominating way, insulting way. You know, if I say to the kid often enough, "You always fail. Why do you always fall down? Why do you always spill in your food? Why don't you ever get A's in school?" And so, pretty soon the kid has internalized that. He thinks of himself as a failure, dumb, no good, and so on. That's personal, covert, psychological. It's not physical. And institutional covert violence, whereas slavery and war would be here. Here is racism, here is sexism, here is any of the injustices that are become standard ways of life. That, you know, I've lost my thought. But what does the way of Jesus, how does it translate into this kind of world of violence? That's our problem. It's not just slapping somebody on the cheek. How does Jesus' way now deal with all of these? Increasingly, we see that personal action isn't going to solve all the world's problems today, because the things that in my congregation, when I had it, there wasn't a single person who wouldn't have fed a poor person if they showed up in our congregation. They'd give them food. They'd have given them money. This happened time after time. But what became institutionalized, that was another matter. In fact, the reason most of them moved out to my area in southern Orange County was to escape all the poor people, the black people, and the busyness of inner city. Probably even have it in Iowa, who knows. But so that now this has to be translated into other techniques of nonviolence. Here, for education, for instance, is part of what active nonviolence is all about. If you're going to affect the institutionalizing of violence, then you have to have a lot of education efforts. You have to let people experience new ways of doing things. Legislation becomes important. If you're going to end sexual harassment, until there are laws having to do with this, you're not going to do much about that violence. So active nonviolence is not just if somebody treats me badly to smile or find a new way, but now is to figure out how to influence our social order so that most of the evil that's happening in our society, it's personal, yes, but it's the institutionalized evil of injustice. And we talked a little yesterday about injustice. Wherever there's injustice, then people start revolting against it. And if there's enough rebellion or reaction to injustice, then the law and order says we got to repress this, we got to stop it, you know. And often the repression simply makes matters worse. And so the nonviolent person says, wait a minute, if we're going to deal with the basic basic violence in our society, we've got to stop revolt, the rebellion, uprising. You know, if there's an uprising in L.A., a riot, yeah, we have to do something about that. But the basic thing we have to do is to attack the injustice and start changing our social order where something is in the wrong relationship to the way God intends. So that active nonviolence isn't just turning the other cheek. How do we get at creating a more just world and a just society? And so that tomorrow I'm going to talk about What is the strategy of people now who are leaders and advocates of active nonviolence or active pacifism? What are, you know, Gandhi had some things to say. Martin Luther King had some things to say. And there's all kinds of conflict resolution programs and efforts underway. So that the way of Jesus has a lot of ways that in modern society, not only I as an individual can start overcoming the violence in my own life and start reacting in a more nonviolent way, but there are institutional and social ways of expressing that effectively. Our time is up.